Indeed, with our special guest tonight, Tom Philbin, as we talk about his work, I Monster, Serial Killers in Their Own Chilling Words. Let's take your phone calls when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Tom, who would you say is the worst serial killer that ever lived?
Albert Fish. He was the guy who...
He's the cannibal, right?
Yeah, he operated in the 20s. And like I said, I think I mentioned that this Bellevue psychiatrist said he had committed... He examined him, and he said he had committed every single sexual perversion that this man, this doctor, had ever heard of. And he preyed on children, and he was just a monster, you know? And I mean, a true monster. And he was the worst, I would say. The thing is that anything involving children is just bad. I mean, like I say, there was some stuff in the book that I couldn't even finish reading. It was just... When it involves kids, it's just, you know, detectives, by the way, hardened detectives, they can be affected by it too. I've seen homicide cops cry, you know.
Is he still alive or is he dead?
Oh, no, he was operating in the 20s, and I don't know, there was a great detective named Will King who tracked him for 5 or 6 years, and we were talking before about people who want to get caught. Fish used an envelope that he found in a boarding house to write a letter to the parents of the girl that he had abducted, a little 10-year-old girl he had abducted.
Oh, yeah, he died at 36, way back.
Yeah, that's right. And he was tracked by Will King through that envelope because he had crossed out the return address on this, and it was a Shaw Forest Benevolent Association, and King, you know, went into this, he had a meeting called the Shaw Forest Benevolent Association, and he said they wanted to know if anybody had, apparently they had found other letters, other envelopes there. He says, wanted to find out who left the envelopes in this particular room, because if he could track that, he could maybe whoever used one of those envelopes was who sent a letter to the mother and was a killer. And it was a brutal letter, as I mentioned. And no one owned up to it. And then finally, you know, King was sitting in a room, and this guy comes in, Sikorsky, I think his name was, and he said, yeah, I use these envelopes, he says, and I left the balance high up on the, in a shelf. In the room, and King traced it. Then he back to this hotel room, and where they found it. And he asked the woman. He says, "Who's handwriting is this?" You know. And he says, "Well," she showed him the register, and he saw this name, Albert Fish, on there. You know, and then he just waited for Fish to show up, and he. Had a brief confrontation with him and captured him. But the reason that Fish found those envelopes was a roach. Apparently a roach was going up the wall, and Fish got up on the bed and to hit the roach, and he saw the envelopes on the shelf. So that's how. But I he was some, I tell you, if you wanted to, one guy after you, you had committed a crime, wouldn't be Will King.
Yeah.
He was a very determined guy.
Well, let's take some calls here. You ready?
Sure.
We'll go to Troy, first-time caller in Washington, state of. Go ahead, Troy. Thanks for calling.
Hi, George. Long-time listener, first-time caller, man. I'm so excited to be on.
Thank you.
Hi, Tom.
How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. If I started out, excuse me. But I turned on the radio just when I heard George ask you if any serial killers had ever committed suicide. And yeah. I believe your answer was no.
I don't know of any. That's my answer.
A couple years ago, I was reading a book called The Encyclopedia of Serial Killers by
Michael Newton,
And in there, I remember reading the story about I believe his name was Joseph D. Ball.
That's years ago.
He killed people and the numbers lost on me, but he fed them to his alligators that he had outside of his store.
Yeah.
In the back of that pond. And when the police cornered him, he went back behind the register and, you know, rang up no sale and pulled out.
No, Troy, you're right. I remember that now. You're absolutely right. And that was the suicide. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Did himself in.
Yep, he did himself in.
Sometimes that's a little easier on society, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thanks,
Troy. They had this suicide by cop now, which is a lot of, you know, they'll get a cops in a confrontation with them, a killer's will.
So is the Zodiac killer alive or dead? What happened?
Well, he's dead, but they think there was a book out by a guy, and he's supposed to be a guy in your area, I think California, who was the killer, and he, they found a lot of physical evidence and handwriting and all that kind of stuff, and I forget the guy's name, but I think it was his cousin or his nephew or something who accused him of being the Zodiac killer in this particular, in the book he wrote, you know, but the Zodiac killer is dead.
All right, next up, let's go to California. AJ, welcome to the program. Hi, AJ.
Hi, George. Hi, Tom.
How you doing there?
I'm doing pretty good. It's a little late for me. I'm a commodity broker, and I trade at night a couple of nights a week, but this is my night off.
Okay.
But so I'm staying up for you guys. I had a serial rapist and killer break into my apartment in 1980. I had just moved into my first apartment. I had just started college, and we had a serial rapist loose in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I remember I had just broken up with my high school sweetheart, and his older brother, who had just gotten out of the Navy, helped me move. And I remember him telling me, I'm going to get you a gun and teach you how to use it. I mean, that's how, you know, we were scared. And anyway, so I was there for about a week, and I was studying, and I had gone out to my car to get some books. And the phone rang, and I didn't lock the door back. And I laid down on the couch, talked for like an hour, and fell asleep because I had been studying. And the next thing I know, there was a man standing in my kitchen yelling, Kathy, Kathy. And so I ran for the front door, but they had just painted it. And so you kind of had to hit it with your hip to unstick it, you know. So he got to me, and we struggled. And I passed out, actually, and for a moment, I remember falling to the floor. I was just terrified. And he had a knife, and he ripped my shirt, and something came over me, and I sat up, and I started crying, and I told him that I had just had both of my ovaries removed, and that if he did anything to me, it would kill me. And my boyfriend left me, and I could never have children. And, I mean, it just, God put words in my mouth. It was just, I mean, and I had had a boat wreck. I had called you about that, George, the one with the Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah.
Where I flipped in the V-drive going 100 miles an hour, and I drowned. And I know there's always this part of me, I wonder, because I relived every moment of my life when I died, but I didn't see the light. I know that I was in the light, and I came back, and when I came back, I couldn't see, the water was so murky, but I did hear a voice outside of my head that said, follow the bubbles, and there was a streak of light, and I know it was divine that I came back. So I always wondered, was it to catch the sky? Somehow I got him, he to sit on the couch, and we sat and we talked for 7 hours.
That's amazing. That's an amazing story.
He had a knife.
Yeah, they don't usually do that, you know. They don't. I mean, rapists are into power, not sex, you know.
Well, his pants, the front part of his pants were wet, and he did confess to me that he had watched me sleeping on the couch and that he had masturbated.
Mm-hmm.
So that urge was kind of, I guess he had, it wasn't as great then.
Confused, yeah.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what happened later. So he took the, you know, he was, I mean, we talked about, he worked at a fish camp as a cook. He had broken up with his girlfriend. I mean, he had these really dark eyes, kind of like Manson's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, though, you know, this was back in the late 70s, early 80s. You know, people had the curly, that's the kind of look people had. So if he walked down the street, I wouldn't point him out as a serial killer.
And what happened to him, finally?
Well, what happened was, I'll tell you how I got him out of the apartment. The detective on the case told me I deserved an Academy Award. He got up, and he went to the bathroom, and he said to me, "Don't try anything." And I remember, I could still see the room today. I looked at the front door, and because we had shuffled, you know, fought when he first came in, things were astray, but my phone was on the floor. So I picked the phone up, and I dialed 911. And as soon as I dialed 911, he was standing right above me.
He saw you do it.
Oh, he grabbed the phone out of my hand. He dragged me down the hall.
You're lucky he didn't beat you to death with it.
He put the knife in my neck and was screaming he was going to kill me. Now, this is something interesting because, George, I've listened to the dual dualities, this dual universe that people talk about. You know, like when you're in a car wreck, that's what it felt like. Everything's in slow motion.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember looking over his right shoulder, and I saw people in my living room carrying me out in a body bag. And I remember looking over his left shoulder, and my father died when I was 12. And I didn't see my father, but I knew he was standing right behind him. And I was just very calm, and I told him that I was calling my mother. Because I was 20 at the time, and that I didn't want her to be afraid that I had forgotten to call her, and I knew that she was going to be worried, and it calmed him down.
Yeah, but how'd you finally get him out of there?
this is a good one. he had, at one point, he had me on the floor, and he was on top of me.
All right, let's get to the bottom.
And he had an erection, and I knew that if he raped me, he would have killed me, and I could hear the car starting up. And so I had to get to school. I said, I've got to turn in these term papers. I had books and stuff all over.
I'm almost out of time. How'd you get
him? I asked him out on a date.
You asked him in on a date?
I asked him out on a date. I said, "You know what? You haven't done anything to me."
And he came. He came back.
Do you like to dance? Do you? You know? He goes, "I don't know how." I said, "Well, you know what? I studied dance 17 years. I'll teach you."
Did you have the cops waiting there?
No, no. And so I wrote down a phone number. It was just a fake number, and he picked up the phone and dialed it. My heart was drumming in my ears, and I went, "Oh my God, that's my old number. Help me find my new one." It was written on the back of the phone book.
How did he get arrested?
Okay, so
you got to tell me today, not tomorrow. How did he get arrested?
When he ripped my shirt, and we were sitting on the couch, he opened his wallet and gave me $6.
Okay, I'm going to let you go. Your story will go on for 6 years. Got to tighten it up. Weird story, though, Tom.
Yeah, very weird, very dangerous story, dealing with somebody like that. I've never heard something like that, of somebody actually sitting down and talking with somebody.
I think she might have been writing it as she was talking.
No, but, rapists are, like I said, my experience with them is, I used to talk to this doctor who was in the sex...
I don't think it happened to her.
I don't either.
No, you can tell, can't you?
Yeah, you can. By the way, it reminded me... A friend of mine who listens to your show religiously, listens to Coast to Coast, he said, you guys are into the psychic and touch stuff like that. I did a book with a psychic named Jeffrey Wands, and when I first started it, I didn't know if I believed it or not, but I'll tell you where I am right now, right in the middle. I couldn't say. He's done amazing things. I saw a psychic do, and there's One of the great detectives in the country, this guy Vernon Gebbett, he has consulted with psychics for solving crimes. You know, so it works. It works. Yeah.
Some of the psychics, though, Tom, are afraid that they're going to get labeled as the suspect because they know things that only the cops know.
You know, that's a danger. I don't blame them. The cops are very, I don't know if you call it linear in your thinking or something, but they're always looking for a suspect, and you got to be very careful when you. A lot of times, people who turn in somebody, they are the first suspect. You know, I remember my first novel. I wrote a novel called The Yearbook Killer, and I went out to Suffolk County, and I introduced myself to the cops. And I said I'd like to find out about homicide and all that kind of stuff, and I got to be very friendly with one of the homicide cops, and we went out a few times, and then he finally revealed me what they thought that, I forgot to say an important thing. This was that case that I'm still obsessed with. They were working on that when I came to them, and they seriously considered me as the killer. As a matter of fact, he took me back to a crime scene and where I had to identify a pole, a light pole with a medallion on it. And as we drove along, he asked me, he said, what would you do with this girl? And blah, blah, blah. And then he says, now, when he was all finished, he says, I hope you don't think I'm refamiliarizing you with the case.
Oh, man.
I said, oh, no. And then that's exactly what he was doing. And so they suspect it's very dangerous for that. But
I've had many psychics. Many psychics have been looked at as the suspect. I mean,
yeah.
They tell a cop this is where the body is. They have to consider them.
Yeah, and sometimes they are. Sometimes they are. As a matter of fact, if you go to a religious service, a funeral, or something like that, cops are there with all kinds of hidden cameras and everything, taking pictures of everybody there. And if somebody's there who doesn't belong, they say, "Why are you here?" And I can, go downhill from there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That happens all the time. Let's go to Tony in Green Valley, Arizona, west of the Rockies. Tony, go ahead.
Hey, I've been calling for years. This is my first time listening. I don't know if you've ever heard the song by Harry Chapin. It gets played a lot less than Cats in the Cradle, but it's called Sniper.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it's over 10 minutes long, epic song. But the lyrics attempt to go into the psyche of the Texas University shooter. If you haven't heard it, check that
Whitman,
one out.
Whitman, yeah.
Whitman, yeah. Mm-hmm.
My question to Tom, real quick, is thinking about how the sociopath feels about himself, only caring about himself, I don't know if you've come across a case like this, but how might they feel, if you care to speculate, if they had a identical twin? And I'll take my answer in my kitchen.
No, what do you mean by that, though?
Oh, yeah. Well, if a sociopath had an identical twin, would they have feelings for him because of their resemblance?
Well, that's interesting.
That's an interesting question, but I don't think they feel about anybody. They've been seriously warped, damaged.
Yeah. They don't have feelings.
Killed. Yeah, that's right.
Tom, we're going to take this break. We're going to come back with final calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Webster Tarpley joins me as we talk about surviving the cataclysm. Get ready for that on Coast to Coast AM. And when we come right back, we'll take final phone calls with Tom Philbin on Coast to Coast AM. Tom, have you heard of that serial killer by the name of Larry Hall? He's in prison now.
No.
He's killed at least 30, they think, maybe more in the Midwest.
Oh, really?
They're all over the place.
Oh, they are, yeah. Like you say, they'll just continue. You know, I remember there was in San Quentin, I think, Bonin, a guy named Bonin, a couple other guys, all serial killers, used to have a bridge club.
Did these guys work at all? Do they have careers?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Other than, of course, the doctor jobs.
Some guys are like long haul truckers, and that's a very convenient thing to be for a. Sorry, I don't mean to.
No, we have a great truckers audience.
I'm sure. I know.
Hey, guys, it's not you.
Yeah, it's not me. And, but they could be executives. They could be just anything. Teachers. Bundy was almost a lawyer. They had this normal life outside. They get married, they have kids, and yet they have still this compulsion to kill, because that's the prime thing, the emotion that they're trying to deal with all the time. You know, I think someday, I think the world will be a better place, a much better place, when if people can recognize the importance of things like the unconscious mind in behavior, and not just look at surface things as causing people to do things. You know, the brain is complex, and it's what that stuff that's buried down there. That's really the way to freedom too. I mean, it cut me loose. Once I found, but I don't know. It just got sort of lost in the shuffle somehow. I don't know.
I don't think they'll ever eradicate it, though. Do you?
Oh no, not at all. No, not at all. Not at all. But I think that people are so mystified and bowled over by these serial killers, and they're just horrified by them and so forth. And yet, you can understand them, you know, and they can be understood, and that's just recognize what goes on in their mind when they face these horrors when they're children. And that's where all the answers are. But there are answers. It's not just something that's going to be, you know, forever a mystery, and we just tremble when some of these people kill somebody else, you know.
All right, let's go back to final calls. First time caller, Deborah in St. Louis. Hey, Deborah.
George, I'm in your neck of the woods here.
Sure? Tom. I'll be there soon enough.
Okay. You probably know this, then. Excuse my voice. I've got laryngitis. But there's a serial killer here in the St. Louis area now in Potosi. He's on death row. His name's Joseph Franklin.
Yep.
I had a Christian call-in talk show about 10 years ago, and he called in. And on the air, my producer let him on from the prison. He said, I want you to find the people in North Carolina and tell them that the man they're about to execute is not the one that killed those two girls. I did.
Wow.
So he already had a string of ones that he'd already been convicted for. The first one here, he's the one that shot Larry Flint and put him in the wheelchair.
Oh, is that right?
Joseph Franklin. And he's also the first one he ever committed was it was a Jewish man. It was a synagogue here in St. Louis. That's why he was being held in Clayton, George. And so my husband called the FBI and reported all of this. We found out it was probably true. And my family wasn't thrilled, but my husband and I went to see this man at Clayton. And I'm a retired high school teacher. One of my former students just happened to be the guard there. And they took us in, and we were sitting face to face through this glass and talked with this man. And you will not believe this, but you can look it up. My husband and Joseph Franklin were born on the same street in Mobile, Alabama, 1950, went to the same school. He did not believe this. He kept questioning my husband, saying, okay, then who's the principal there at the high school, and what's the name of the high school? And he said, Murphy High School. And he said, who was the choir teacher? And when my husband could answer all of these, it was like we had an end to him, and I saw his eyes change. He was a scared little boy. And I've seen this with my students before. I helped start our alternative school here at Lindbergh, George. And I saw him melt, and we prayed with him. And I don't know, Tom, if you believe that there is redemption in serial killers. Most people say they don't deserve it. But I know, but for the grace of God.
I think there's redemption for everybody.
I do, too.
Well, to a point, I wouldn't let him on the street.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And whatever the consequences, the consequences. But I believe that somewhere, somebody could have intervened. And that's what we have to do in the schools today with the kids that are growing up with such horrid situations that have no way out and no voice to tell anyone.
I agree.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you.
All right. This guy apparently killed 7 to 20 people.
Right. By the way, I was just thinking when you said St. Louis, St. Louis was actually the setting of Thomas Harris's The Red Dragon, and Princess Dolahide, his fictional serial killer, came from St. Louis.
Well, also for part of The Exorcist.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Okay. Old hospital there the little boy was in. It was really a little boy, by the way.
Who was a little boy?
The kid who was exorcised. You know the movie, The Exorcist?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
It was
about a little boy. Oh, is that right? Oh,
yeah.
That was the real, based on real life life story.
Yep. Let's go to Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. Let's go to Sig. How do I pronounce your first name? Sig?
Hi.
Okay.
Hi.
Go ahead, Sig.
Hi, George and Tom.
Hi.
My I have some questions about Michael Ross and a couple others. Michael Ross strangled 8 women in Connecticut. In his childhood, his father made him strangle the male chicks on their poultry farm.
Oh, my God.
And Robert Hansen, who killed 30 women in Alaska, was a bow and arrow hunter. And Jeffrey Dahmer said in one of his final interviews that it was in a high school biology class that he first liked the feel of dead flesh. And finally, Robert Picton, who fed 60 prostitutes to his pigs, was a pig farmer. So I just think there's a correlation between being a butcher or a lab animal researcher like Dr. Michael Swango was for a while, or being trained to kill in the military that has some fallout.
I go back to childhood, just whatever's in. It all starts there. I think the jobs they get are, I don't know that they play a big role in their behavior. You know, in my thinking, their behavior is already set by the time they get to be a certain age, you know.
It is amazing how they make these serial killers when they're kids.
Yeah, and manufacture them. That's exactly right. It's rare, though, isn't it? You figure there's only 70 roaming the country today, according to the FBI, you know, but... I mean, the childhood, you must have a horrific childhood, and we haven't even touched on some of the stuff. Some of the callers did, you know, but, you know, it's not just somebody being, it's somebody being, you know, insanely cruel to somebody, and they react. You know, human beings react. They protect themselves. And in one way, you might think of serial killers as just protecting themselves against being murdered by their own mothers.
Well, you know, like Dahmer and the rest like that, are they put in the general prison population?
Yeah, they are. That's why Dahmer got killed. He had an altercation with another prisoner.
What happens to the person who killed them? Nobody ever hears about them.
Well, yeah.
They don't get convicted again.
Yeah, right.
Do they?
They might try them, or if the guy has like 60 years on an original sentence, they say why. You know, and then they'll just hold it in abeyance. They can always file charges.
And a lot of times, you know,
the statute on
guys killed in a crowd, they don't even know who did it.
Oh, no, that's right. Yeah. Well, the bad thing about prison is the people you have to spend the time with. You know, there's some of these guys. Some of them are changed and all, but, you know, some of them are just horrific, horrifically terrifying people in prison, you know, and... They live by a code of an ethics or whatever that's exactly reverse what we should all live with love and, you know, kind of Christian ways and so forth, you know, and yet they count being tough, if you're a killer and all, those are the, hey, you're a great guy, you're the best, you know, they count those things as valuable, and the softness and the love and all that is invaluable, not valuable at all.
Let's go to Montreal, east of the Rockies there. Hey, Mike, go ahead.
Hey, how are you doing tonight, George?
Good, Michael.
I'm a first-time caller.
Thank you.
I was watching the History Channel or A&E, and they were talking about one of the most vicious serial killers, I think, was Jack the Ripper. And this homicide detective that was hired by some people in England tracked. See if they can identify Jack the Ripper, and they ended up identifying a guy who escaped from a mental hospital. When this guy escaped, a week later, the Ripper murder started. They ended up tracking him all the way to the States.
Really?
He killed at least 5+, and they also had thought for a while that he was a member of the royal family.
Right.
You remember that?
There's an interesting book by, I know, yes, I know that, yes. There's an interesting book by Patricia Cornwell, I think her name is, and she's a very respected writer. She did a whole book on Jack the Ripper and traced who she believes is the killer. So I never read it, but that's who she felt. I think if anybody's really interested, that would be a good book to read.
I had interviewed 2 police officers, and they had written a book about this, and this is years ago, but apparently Jack the Ripper was a doctor, And he went to St. Louis, Missouri.
Okay.
And he died there of a heart attack. Now, that was a bizarre theory.
Yeah, well, I think some of the cuts were surgical. Otherwise, they said somebody who had skill.
With precision.
Yeah, precision. Somebody had done invasive surgery, whoever cut these women, you know. And so that would work out there.
Whitechapel murders.
Yep, the Whitechapel murders, yeah.
Let's go to Karen in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hi, Karen. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to find out some information on Bittaker and Norris. When I was about 15, I was waiting for my mom to pick me up from the beach. And anyway, those two pulled up in their van and snapped a picture of me. And,
oh, my God.
And
oh, my God.
Yeah, and it really didn't bother me back then much. But anyway, I'm a survivor of those two. They asked me if I wanted to go party with them and get in their van. And
jeez.
I said no and said my mom will be here any minute. So anyway, I was just wondering if, you know, are they on death row or
Yeah, I don't know if they're dead yet, but they were with Bonin. I think those were his two partners in playing bridge every week or so. But I'd be interested. What made you say no? Getting in their van.
Yeah, they're still alive, by the way.
Oh, they are? Okay.
No, I just wasn't that kind of kid. I wouldn't have gone with any strangers.
I'll tell you something. I had a very interesting thing with a serial killer, very close contact with one, Berkowitz. My wife and I...
Son of Sam.
Yeah, Son of Sam. My wife and I had young daughters at the time. They wanted to go to this, like, club that's not non-alcoholic, just dancing club. And I said, yeah, sure, go ahead. It was on Huntington, New York. And I said, go ahead. Well, my wife said, no, this guy, Son of Sam, you never know what he's going to do. I said, oh, come on. Don't worry about it. And so she said, no. So it was no. She said, he couldn't go. Okay. Later on, it turned out that the demons that controlled, oh, we were talking about demons before, he's one guy that had them. The demons who controlled the dog that gave the orders to Son of Sam ordered him to go out to Huntington, Long Island, my hometown, and to go, you know, and he was headed on his way to this place, this dance place, where my daughter
would have been. Jeez.
Would have been. And then the demons said, no, not tonight. Go turn around and go out and back.
Mm.
And same thing with Southampton. He was on his way out there, and he had a high-powered AK-47 or something. He was going to just slaughter people. And apparently it started to rain, and that was a sign not to go. You know, so he came back. But that was
terrifying. I mean, when you talk about it, there's really nothing you can do. You can't give people tips on what to avoid or anything, can you?
Not
with a serial killer, because you don't know who they are.
I would say, you know, there's a book years ago, a guy wrote a book called On Fear. I forget his name, but it was a very good book. And just trust your gut. Don't ever get yourself into a situation with somebody you don't know. And
old saying, keep away from strangers.
Yeah, I mean, just don't get yourself in a situation. And if there's warnings issued by a school or something, listen to them. And, you know, there's nothing basically that you could do, you know. Except trust your instincts, you know. So you the gut is a great, you know, it's terrific at detecting danger. And that's what I would suggest. But there's no, you can't, like we say, we can't spot a serial killer, you know.
Where do you get your book, I, Monster?
You know, it's for sale on Amazon and in bookstores now.
You don't have a website, do you?
No. Mm-mm.
You may be the only guy who's been on this show ever who doesn't have a website.
I don't even know what a computer is, George.
Oh, come on. How did you write your book?
No, I do. I'm only kidding.
One of those old Peckin.
Andy Rooney still uses a typewriter.
The old typing kind, yeah.
Yeah, but no, I don't have a website. I should. I guess I should. I don't know if I got mentioned, but I've written a couple of funny cop books too, you know, funniest cop stories ever and all. And, you know, that's a good one too, if people want to laugh.
What serial killer would you like to interview face to face?
Me?
Yeah.
If I had a choice of,
yeah.
Let's see, who would I like to interview? I'd like to interview, David Parker, the guy down in, New Mexico. You know, he was a pure sociopath and all, but there was something about his, he had regrets and he was destroyed by his family. And or I'd like to talk to Lucas too. I just like to see what they say about things, you know, but of course many times they don't know. They don't have a clue
no.
what's motivating.
They really don't.
All of the time.
They don't. Tom, no. Thank you for being on the program. The name of the book, I'm Monster. And they are monsters. Make no doubt about that. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Will Wilkerson, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lottisour, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.